doesn't mean you should fire somebody who's equally horrible.
So it means,
no, you need to hire somebody who actually understands academia. You need to hire somebody who is an academic and appreciates academia, but for some reason wants to do this horrible job. That's what you want. You don't want a CEO. That's number two. Number two is Bardo. Excuse me, Steven.
Whatever.
Actually, he's Yurtle the Turtle. Do you know Dr. Seuss?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All right. I'm Yurtle the Turtle, and marvelous me, for I am the ruler of all that I see. That's kind of number two.
Let's get started.
If we hire him, I'm going to set myself on fire on the president's lawn.
Okay.
But it's a terrible job. It usually comes with a nice house. So our perk is our president lives in a nice house that's right on the ocean cliff, whatever. So he has a terrible job, but he gets to live in a nice place for 5 years.
My criteria is that I know they're not going to be helpful to me. Just don't get my way. And whatever you're proposing, don't be so too aggressive about it.
Well, we should get started. It's two after. Welcome to the Continuing Physics Seminar Series. Our speaker today comes from us from Canada, University of British Columbia, originally from Montreal. Has spent a long time working in the world of a CP violation. And we had Jim Cronin here some time ago who was talking about cosmic rays, but discovered CP violation in the K0 system. And it's been a long effort, 10 years effort on my part in that experiment as well. And now, Janice is going to tell us about the above bar experiment and B physics and its CP violation grasp.
Actually, so excuse me. So last night, actually, I thought when I heard it was mostly undergrad university, I actually changed my talk a bit to be a hybrid between what I do for our fourth year students, because I thought there would be undergrads here.
But one of our grad students showed up.
One of our grad students, okay. Okay, so I'm going to talk about an experiment we've been working on to look at the difference between matter and antimatter asymmetry. And I'll use antimatter, matter asymmetry, and charge parity violation almost interchangeably through this. And I'll explain to you what it is in a minute. So this is an outline of what I'll go over today, sort of particles, antiparticles, symmetries of nature. So first of all, we're going to discuss a little bit about what matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe is. And then I'll talk about what charge parity violation is and the difference between matter and antimatter and how it fits into the standard model of particle physics. And then I'll go a bit about our experiment and how we measure this matter-antimatter asymmetry, which is how we measure charge parity violation, in a system of B mesons. B mesons are just the bound state of a beautiful quark with an anti-down quark. And then some of our work on looking for new physics beyond the standard model. And then we'll look at the hardware to examine the problem, which is the accelerator we've been using at Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and then the detector, which we call Babar. You know, that was a big political process, naming the darn thing. It sort of looks like BB Bar, and this original spokesman really loved it. So yeah, we got permission from Lauren de Bruinhoff's living nephew to use the Babar Geyser logo. And then I'll talk about what we've learned. So, you know, we often wonder, what is the universe made of? Does the universe have a beginning and an end? Where did all this stuff in it come from? Are there other universes out there? And one question we often ask is, you know, gee, is it all matter? Or is it matter and antimatter? And it looks like there's no antimatter in the universe. And if so, where is all the antimatter? And sort of that's the subject of this talk, is, you know, where is all the antimatter? Because if the universe was created in a Big Bang, you'd expect the universe to be, you know, equal parts, 50-50, matter and antimatter, or pure energy, because matter and antimatter can annihilate into energy, but you wouldn't expect some asymmetry. So what's really surprising is that our universe is not equal parts of matter and antimatter, so the antimatter seems to be missing. So that's a serious problem in particle physics. It keeps a lot of particle physicists up at night. And you sort of ask yourself, gee, how could a universe that was originally half and half, equal parts matter and antimatter, spontaneously generate this asymmetry to be mostly, if not all, matter with hardly any antimatter? So there's a huge asymmetry there between matter and antimatter, and that's sort of the basic topic of this talk. So I'll go into a bit about the background, but first I'm just to sort of set it in context. I'll tell you how we do the experiment and then what we're looking for and how we look for it. So we've been running this at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. Actually, we stopped running 2.5 years ago. We're still finishing and analyzing our data, And actually what we find in this experiment, it's nice when you stop running the experiment, because now actually we're putting out papers at a much greater rate than we did when we were actually running the experiment and had less time to analyze. So this is the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. It's at Stanford University. Interesting feature is the San Andreas Fault, which is one of the largest earthquake faults in California, is right back there. So every time there's even a minor earthquake, like magnitude 4 and above, a lot of the accelerator components have to be realigned. So this is a 2-mile linear accelerator. Electrons and positrons are injected and accelerated. Electrons are injected into the ring in one direction, positrons in the other direction, and the electrons and positrons both collide at one point in the ring, in this building here underground, and that's where we have a detector named Babar right here. So I'll go into more details on that a bit later. And so just to give you an outline of where we're going, this is a, I just look at this. This is my whole university career. So in 1993, I went to the University of British Columbia, and with one other person, we started the Canadian group to worry about starting a Canadian group to work on charge parity violation. And at that time, we hadn't even decided whether it was going to be at Cornell or Stanford. It was just a matter of, go wherever things could be funded. So between 1993 and 1999, I was just designing prototypes for the detectors. The Canadians, we ended up building the drift chamber, so we were doing prototypes to try to discover what gas should we use, what high voltage should we run the detectors at. And the first 6 years was basically designing and constructing. And 1998, we sent our detector down to SLAC, was installed, and we didn't start taking data until 1999. In 2001, so after we'd been running less than 2 years, we saw one of the things we'd been looking for, which was charge parity violation in a system of B mesons. Now, as Nick mentioned, it had been seen actually originally by Jim Cronin, Fitch and Cronin, way back in 1964, so in a kaon system. They got a Nobel Prize for that. It was the first time charge parity violation ever had been discovered. And it hadn't been seen in any other system. For 27 years, people were looking at this charge parity matter-antimatter symmetry phenomenon, and we couldn't understand where does it originate, what does it come from. In those 27 years, the matter-antimatter symmetry in the kaon system had been measured to greater and greater precision, but measuring something to greater precision, getting more decimal points on how much its CP is violated, doesn't tell you a lot about the origin. So we had a very precise measurement of charge parity violation in the kaon system by the time we started, but still weren't quite sure where it came from. I'll get into that a bit later. And then here's some of the other things that have happened. So while we're looking for charge parity violation, we found that actually charge parity violation and then indirect charge parity violation a few years later, so direct charge parity violation a few years later. We found some new particles on the way, observed mixing in some other systems. And our last run was in 2008. And so since then, we've been actually analyzing. So the charge parity violation was our number one priority. Most of the analysis for that are finished. But what we've been doing in the past couple of years is actually just getting a data mining all the physics we can out. So we found a number of new charm resonances. And then in 2008, Kobayashi Maskawa got a Nobel Prize for their model of CP violation. And now what we're doing is in this final stage, finishing analysis and writing papers. So when you go back to, what is the world made of, what holds it together, 100 years ago, all we had was the periodic table, right? We figured it could explain everything. Everything's made up of these fundamental atoms. These atoms are the basic building blocks of everything in nature. And we understood how these atoms were organized into the periodic table. But then along came early 1900s, our whole view of everything changed about what is a fundamental particle. So by about 1910, we knew that the fundamental building blocks of nature were atoms and not the, so this is the atoms in the periodic table. A little bit later, we discovered that actually the atom actually had a hard nucleus in it. Rutherford showed this in his experiments, a hard nucleus in it. So this was in about, not much longer than that later. And then in the 1960s, it was shown that inside each nucleus were three things, quarks, and then inside the nucleus were nucleons, and inside those were quarks. And right now, actually, one of the things we've been looking at is there any substructure in quarks? And there's ways we've been able to look at this. So here, we've replaced the periodic table with this sort of particle physicist periodic table, where there's actually only six fundamental matter particles. Those are up and down quarks, charm and strange, top and bottom quarks. And this bottom quark, or the beautiful quark, is going to be the one where we're studying charge parity violation. Charge parity violation was first seen in a system with strange quarks in the 1960s, and so it hadn't been seen since that time. So we are in a matter-dominated universe, and how do we know it? Well, we know, first of all, the moon's not antimatter, because here's Buzz Aldrin. When he stepped on it, if the moon was antimatter, and we know Buzz was matter because he was here on Earth, they would have annihilated in a burst of light. So moon's not antimatter. And even on a solar system scale, there's a solar wind that blows particles past all the planets. If any of them were antimatter, of course, you would have seen annihilations, no antimatter. On larger scales, and even on the Milky Way scale, even on the galactic scale, we don't see any evidence of large galaxies of matter and antimatter annihilating in bursts of light. So, you know, as far as we can see in our universe, it looks like it's made up of only matter and no antimatter. And so that's a sort of problem. Where did this asymmetry come from? Even Michelangelo, of course, on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, knew that God must be matter as well, because when he reached out and touched Adam, they didn't annihilate in a burst of light. So, you know, God is not antimatter either. Now, so you can say, where is all the antimatter? You know, the universe was created in a hot Big Bang, and it would have created matter and antimatter particles in pairs. And so we really expect, at that time, the early first 10 to the minus 40 seconds of the universe or whatever, we'd have a universe that's half matter, half antimatter, and whatever's not matter and antimatter would be energy, as the matter and antimatter annihilate into pure energy and form into pairs. So it's super duper surprising. The universe is not equal parts of matter and antimatter. So you could say, what happened to all that antimatter? So it must have been made at the Big Bang. So here's sort of the scenario of what happened. So there was a hot Big Bang, equal parts matter and antimatter. The matter and antimatter annihilate, and they make energy, pure energy or photons. But somewhere along the way, there must have been some process that had very slightly different decay rates for matter and antimatter that over time would generate this huge difference in the matter and antimatter abundances. So, you know, you can make some models and make it look like, you know, if you had equal parts of matter and antimatter, but a tiny, tiny extra bit of matter over antimatter, most of the matter and antimatter would annihilate, and that tiny little excess then could be, you know, that would annihilate to energy, and a tiny little excess of matter with no antimatter left would form everything we see in the universe. Now, one thing cosmologists have done recently, so I was just looking, WMAP, this is some of my colleagues in my department are on this Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. It's actually an experiment that looks at the cosmic microwave background, the sort of echoes of the Big Bang. It's a satellite experiment that looks at the, you know, basically the structure of the early universe. One thing they've done is measured the matter to baryon to photon ratio. And so we have lots of sort of hints on, you know, what we'd expect at the time of the big universe, how many baryons were in the universe, how many photons. And that's useful to us because actually one of the models that people wanted to test was, let's say we had, for every 10 billion and one particles of matter, we had only 10 billion particles of antimatter. So we have a lot of matter, a lot of antimatter, but there's a slight excess of matter over antimatter, one part in 10 billion. Well, what you'd expect to see is that matter and antimatter would annihilate. Each annihilation gives you two photons. So we'd expect to see 20 billion photons, so energy, plus this one lonesome matter particle left over. So all the antimatter got annihilated with the matter, but the one leftover guy is here. And so, you know, given the results of the recent cosmology experiments from WMAP, so you can predict the abundances of elements in the universe would be predicted. And then what you'd see is, okay, we'd have this tiny, tiny excess of matter went on to be all the matter we see in our universe. So all the matter we see in our universe is just a minuscule fraction of what the matter and antimatter was right after the Big Bang. Most of it annihilated, and this is the residual leftovers, which makes our entire universe. So this is one model people have looked at. And you could say, thank God, after you see this, that the universe wasn't equal parts matter and antimatter. Because if it was, everything would have annihilated. There'd just be pure energy, and we wouldn't be here. So it's sort of good. There's a little bit of asymmetry there. And then you can say, gee, where is that antimatter? So here's the composition of the universe as we know it. Actually, so a lot of this information comes from those cosmology experiments like WMAP, looking at the universe, you know, what's it made of. So it looks to like, actually, we only know what 4.5% of the universe is. So we know that, you know, the heavy elements in the universe are only like 0.03% of the mass of the universe. Most of the universe that we know is just 4.5%, which is free hydrogen and helium and, you know, the heavy elements in the stars and stuff. So this is really embarrassing. 4.5% of the stuff in our entire universe is stuff we know, and more than 95% is stuff we don't even know. How could we be so terrible? We don't even know what 95% of the stuff in our universe is. So this is clearly new physics. Actually, so a large fraction of it from actually WMAP and astrophysics studies looks like it's a dark matter, and then 70% of it is even worse, something in this dark energy. So we don't know what these things are. We only see this 5% of the matter we know in our universe. So, okay. So here's a map of sort of the history of our universe all in one slide. Basically, from the time of the Big Bang, at 10 to the minus 43 seconds past the Big Bang is when we entered this inflationary era in our universe. And you can see, so as we're going along, so here we are right now, 13.7 billion years past the Big Bang, where the universe was stars and galaxies and planets and our life here. But if you look back, 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, elementary particles, matter and antimatter, were common and probably in equal abundance. By the time you get to 3 minutes, so at the end of Steven Weinberg's book, The First 3 Minutes, you'll notice all the matter has annihilated with antimatter, and all we have left after 3 minutes after the Big Bang are protons, neutrons, electrons, and neutrino, and already at that time, antimatter is rare. So not only is it a question of where did the antimatter go, man, the antimatter left was gone. By the time the universe was 3 minutes old, there was no more antimatter, and here we're evolving into our universe now. So that Big Bang of pure energy now formed matter and antimatter symmetry very, very early in the formation of the universe. Now, one way you'd like to explain, how could you have developed this huge matter and antimatter symmetry? There's one guy who was actually pretty central in actually proposing a solution to this problem. He said, well, it's possible to start with the universe of matter and antimatter, a very symmetric universe, and make an anti-symmetric one. All you'd need are 3 conditions to be present. So one would be to have a universe not in thermal equilibrium. Well, our universe is not in thermal equilibrium. It's expanding and cooling down, so good that's met. You'd have to have processes which violate baryon number. Actually, we have some of those in the standard model. And then we'd have to have some processes which violate matter and antimatter symmetry. So Sakharov, I guess he spent a lot of his time, he was the father of the Russian H-bomb project. He later became a great peace activist. He lived in exile in the middle of nowhere in Russia for a long time. So even when he got his Nobel Peace Prize in 1975, he had to send his wife to go pick him up because those Russians didn't believe he'd, I guess, come back to Russia. So he had a long time living in exile to work on this problem. You know, I guess he could be working, how could I escape, how could I get out of here? But instead he was saying, hey, you know, there's a problem with the universe. There's this matter-antimatter symmetry. While I'm here in exile, I might as well go and solve it. So these are the conditions he came up with. And so actually these 3 conditions are actually no problem for the standard model of physics. They're all part of the standard model of physics. So he was the first one to sort of propose a mechanism by which you could have this matter and antimatter symmetry. And it would the big requirement is that you'd have to have some processes which violate matter-antimatter symmetry, some processes which violate charge parity symmetry, so some processes which exhibit charge parity violation. Now, this matter and antimatter symmetry, so one thing we know from CPT theorem, so charge parity time reversal symmetry, is particles and antiparticles must always, always, always have the same mass and same lifetime. Actually, my string theorist friends always remind me, we have 4 string theorists in my department, so they always remind me, Dennis, CPT is not God's word, whatever, because there are string theories which violate CPT symmetries. But for most of us who are not string theorists, this is like a sacred rule of life, right? Charge parity time reversal symmetry. So in that case, particles and antiparticles will have the same mass, same lifetime, but they can have different, of course, partial rates to selected final states as long as the complete decay rate for particles and antiparticles are the same, even though the sub-channels might be different. And so CP violating lets us have particles and antiparticles with different decay rates to final states. And as I mentioned and Nick mentioned, antimatter-matter symmetry was first seen in the Kaon system by Fitch and Cronin way back in 1964, but it was tiny. That matter and antimatter symmetry seen in the Kaon system was minuscule. Now those, as I mentioned, those parameters, the CP violating parameters in the Kaon system have been measured to amazing, amazing precision in the 50 years since then. But there's another sort of problem that I mentioned. So there's a cosmological matter and antimatter symmetry, right? And that's huge. So the charge parity violation seen in 1964 in the Kaon system is minuscule. The charge parity, you know, the cosmic baryon asymmetry of the universe is absolutely enormous. So one question you ask, wow, are both manifestations of this antimatter-matter asymmetry rooted in the same phenomenon? Could we have the same model in theory explain the tiny charge parity or matter-antimatter asymmetry seen in the Kaon system and the huge matter-antimatter asymmetry seen, you know, in the formation of the universe? Okay, so 1964, I mentioned, is when that charge parity violation was first discovered. It was not explained. It was unexpected when it was discovered. It was not explained by the standard model. In 1973, two theorists came along, Kobayashi and Mascala. They postulated a mechanism by which this charge parity violation, which was seen in the Kaon system by Fitch and Cronin, you know, almost a decade earlier, they postulated a mechanism by which it could be explained. But it was far out at the time. At the time, there were only three quarks, Kipolua, up, down, and strange. And so they said, gee, you know, we can explain this charge parity violation if you let us invent three more types of quarks that have not been seen. So people go like, wow, this is, you know, they can't do it by adding only a fourth quark. They couldn't do it with adding a fifth quark. You'd need enough freedom to add six quarks to be able to accommodate and incorporate this charge parity violation. So that was a far out theory at the time, predicted three generations of quarks, but it could beautifully and elegantly, especially to mathematicians, explain how matter and antimatter symmetry could originate via the interactions of the quarks. But they had to double the number of quarks, and this looked way out. But, you know, it agreed with experimental results. So that it had that going in its favor. So even though, probably like the way we look at string theory now, not a desirable theory, it looks way out, whatever, if it agrees with experimental results, which string theory doesn't, by the way, it doesn't predict anything, then actually, so this was taken very seriously. So on our experiment, our goal was to say, boy, you know, this is a mathematically beautiful theory and model they made, but could it be the real explanation to charge parity violation? So our goal in our experiment was to find an inconsistency in this theory of Kobayashi and Mascala. Find a place where it breaks down by doing precise and rigorous experiments to look at matter and antimatter asymmetry from many different attack points. So not just in the Kaon system, but look at it in a system of B mesons using many different channels. So what we were hoping was to find some inconsistency or some place where it breaks down, because even though this is an absolutely beautiful and elegant theory, man, it seems so contrived, and we were hoping to break it down. So that was sort of the goal when we started in 1993 to do this experiment. Find a place where we could break down that Kobayashi-Mascala theory and find the real theory of charge parity violation. So I'll just go over it. So here's the standard model of particle physics. I mentioned before, there's six quarks, up, down, charm, strange. Top and bottom are truth and beauty. So I did my PhD over in Germany, in the German experiment. We used to call this truth and beauty, not top and bottom. But I guess Americans call it top and bottom. And then there's neutrinos. So there's an electron, muon, and tauon, and the neutrinos that are partnered with them. And these particles here are the force carriers. They're the gauge bosons that carry the information for the electroweak force, the strong force, this is a gluon, or photon, which is the electromagnetic force, and of course the graviton is missing. We haven't fit in a quantum theory of gravity. The string theorists I keep mentioning are trying to do that. No success yet, but someday we might have a graviton down here. And of course there's probably a Higgs boson that fits into here that they're looking for at the Large Hadron Collider that would actually give rise to the mass of these things. Because in the basic standard model of particle physics, these guys, the particles don't have mass there. They're put in by hand later. And so the Higgs boson should have some clue into why these particles have the masses they have. So I circled the B quark here, the bottom quark of the beautiful quark, because that's what we're going to be looking at. So, you know, in the 20th century, so this is actually a very simple model. It's sort of the new periodic table for particle physicists. There have been thousands and thousands of tests of the interactions of these things. You want to know, you know, we can predict the lifetime of the muon to high precision and the tauon. We can predict how particle bound states of these particles decay into each other, the branching ratios. So there's hundreds and thousands of measurements that have been performed testing the standard model of particle physics. It only has a few parameters, And in every case, we've always come up, the experimental results always agree with the predictions of this beautiful and simple model. But it does have a couple of problems, as I mentioned. The Higgs boson is not included. There's no carrier of the gravitational force, the graviton. And it wasn't obvious, actually, how charge parity or matter-antimatter symmetry could be explained. So I won't go too much into the details, but I'll just go over sort of this theory of weak interactions and Kobayashi and Moskawa, what they proposed. So they proposed these quarks here. The downstrange and bottom quarks were not really, the ones that participated in the weak interaction were not the same quarks that participated in the strong interactions. So the strong interaction had these six quarks, up, charm top, downstrange, bottom, would participate in the strong interactions, but in the weak interactions, there would be a mixture of these things. So it would be a mixture of the downstrange or bottom quarks with the other quarks that would participate. So if you like, there was sort of a rotation in the basis of the quarks that participate in the strong interactions and the quarks that participate in the weak interactions, and the transformation matrix that tells us how these strong eigenstates mix to make the weak eigenstates, the quarks that participate in the weak interaction, this mixing matrix is what Kobayashi and Moskawa proposed way back in 1973. So at the time, there were only four quarks, and Kibibo had a beautiful model to explain mixing of the three-quark system, and it was called the Kibibo matrix, so they extended this to a 3x3 matrix, which required six quarks instead of four quarks. And so the mixing matrix can be parametrized a number of ways, and one of the ways we like to parameterize it is like this, in terms of just three parameters. So this is just basically, you know, nine elements in this matrix, but this matrix is unitary, so it means the complex conjugate of the transpose times itself would be one. And so what we can extract, you know, in the standard model with three quark generations, what we can do is parameterize this thing as having three parameters, this A for an amplitude up front, a rho and an eta. Now, what we're doing in our experiment is we're going to measure this rho and eta. And if this complex eta, so this eta always is preceded by an I, complex I, if this eta is zero, then we would be able to disprove this charge parity violation model of Kibibo, Kobayashi, and Moskawa. So one of our first goals was to measure this eta parameter. And if it's zero, then we've actually killed Kobayashi and Moskawa's model. And then so you could say what we're doing is testing whether this complex eta here in the CKM matrix could be responsible for the baryonic symmetry of the universe. Is that actually the source of charge parity violation in the standard model of particle physics? So what we were hoping to do is to break down and kill Kobayashi Moskawa's model by showing that thing was zero or inconsistent. So the way we do it is we make lots of B particles and we watch them decay to different decay channels, and we measure the way they decay. We watch them decay to, you know, final states with up quarks and neutrinos, final states with D mesons and K mesons, some charm mesons with leptons and neutrinos. And each time we measure a different decay channel, we're getting a different handle on different elements in that CKM, the Kobayashi Kibibo Moskawa matrix. So every time we're measuring different decay channels, we're getting different measurements on different parameters in this matrix. So what we're doing effectively is finding lots of different experiments to measure these parameters in different ways. Some of them are very independent of each other, so that we can do a consistency test and a test of Kobayashi Moskawa's model to explain charge parity violation. So what we've done is measured, we call this thing the unitarity triangle, and the angles of the triangle we measure the CP asymmetries in BDK. So each side and angle corresponds to some set of possible decays of these B mesons and B0 mesons. So what we want to do is do many, many predictions and see if everything's consistent. Because, of course, if you measure two of the angles, the third angle will be given, right? It'll be 180 minus the sum of the other two and so on. So we're going to do lots of consistency tests and look for the origin of CP violation by the constraints on this thing, and then look backwards at the implications it has. Does this explain charge parity violation? So now, how do we actually measure those decays and the asymmetries? Here's how we do it. We make lots of B mesons. So we made more than 9 million B meson, anti-B meson pairs and collected and watched them decay. What we do is reconstruct one of them to a charge parity eigenstate. That's actually a final state, which is the charge parity, under a charge parity operation, it's the same thing. So it would be particles like a bound state of a charm, anti-charm quark,
if you do a CP operation on that, you get the same thing, because it's actually just made of, if you switch all the particles and antiparticles, you get back the same thing. So we reconstruct one of the B mesons into a CP eigenstate, and the other we tag, and we watch it decay, and find enough of its decay products to determine, was it a B0 meson or an anti-B0 meson? And then we reconstruct those things and look at the time difference between these decays and extract and fit the parameters of this Kobayashi-Miskawa theory. So what we effectively do is like a quantum mechanics double slit experiment. When we have these B mesons, a B meson can decay as a B meson to fuse a final CP eigenstate. So this is a bound state of a charm anti-charm quark with a K short. So a B meson can decay as a B meson, or it can oscillate into its own antiparticle, a B0 meson, and then decay to the same final state. And so when you have two roots to the same final state, these two guys can interfere quantum mechanically. So it's sort of a double slit interference type experiment. So this B system is a great place to study this matter and antimatter symmetry due to two strokes of luck. One is this B meson lifetime is so darn long. It's 1.5 picoseconds, which doesn't sound very long, but to a particle physicist, this is super duper long. So it lives for long enough to actually, so that it actually has time to mix like this. And then these neutral B mesons have large mixing, thanks to the fact that the top quark ended up being so heavy, so the mixing between these is very strong. And so to access that critical parameter, that eta parameter in the Kobayashi-Miskawa's matrix, what we need to do is measure the interference between the direct path to a final state and the path where it mixes to its antiparticle and goes to the final state. So we're going to measure the interference between these two to extract those parameters in Kobayashi-Miskawa's mixing matrix. So, you know, there's sort of some problems. One problem is it's hard to tell a B meson from an anti-B meson when they decay into final states, which are CP eigenstates. So what you do is you just watch one of them decay into a CP eigenstate. You don't know whether that was a B0 or a B0 bar. Then you take the other one, and it will decay into a final state that's not a charge parity eigenvalue state. That one you can tell, was it a B0 or a B0 bar? And because they're produced B0 and B0 bar, they actually come from a bound state, the fourth S state of a bound state of a B and anti-B quark. This is a coherent state, a quantum state, and so when it decays, one is a B0 and one is a B0 bar. They can't both be B0s or B0 bars. One is one. So as soon as one decays into either a B or a B0, you know at that same instant of time, the other was the opposite. And so what we use that, so we using the fact that these are we're producing a coherent pair, we can actually tag them, which one, was it a B0 or a B0 bar? And then we perform a time-dependent measurement to observe the asymmetry. So you can figure they're produced as B0, B0 bar, each is mixing. When one decays, now we know what it is, and so we know at the starting point what the second one was until it decays. And what we're going to do is look at the distance. Actually, so these two, we boost the center of mass a lot. So one of them will decay as a B0 or B0 bar. At that same instant, the other will be somewhere, and it will be oscillating. And what we're going to do is measure the time between the two decays. But measuring the time, we do that indirectly by measuring the distance between the decays, and of course we have the velocity and the boost, so we can get the time between the decays. So we do time-dependent measurements to observe the asymmetry between the matter and antimatter. I just put down, so the weak transition, so, you know, I thought there were going to be more undergrads here. So normally you don't think of a particle spontaneously changing into its own antiparticle, and it wouldn't happen with a particle like a proton, because an antiproton has the opposite charge. But for neutral mesons, it is possible. And so for a B meson, it has to actually undergo two weak interactions. So I can have a B quark and an anti-D quark. They can exchange a W boson, mediating the weak force. And that B quark would then be an up charm or top quark. And then it would exchange a second B meson. So then the initial state, which was a bound state of a B quark and an anti-D quark, would now be a D quark and an anti-B. So the particle has now transformed by a doubly weak interaction into its own antiparticle. So this thing would happen, and happens all the time. And then if you want to write down how it mixes, so this is a B meson just sitting there as a function of time. It's sitting there. It has a lifetime of about 1.5 picoseconds. So it'll follow an exponential decay distribution, so there's sort of an exponential envelope. And at any given time, it's going to be oscillating part B meson, anti-B meson, as it evolves with time. So if it starts out in the pure B meson state, it'll be mixing, so there'll be a cosine theta, sine theta mixture of B and anti-B. So at any point in time, based on if we understand the oscillation parameters, we could figure out if it's a B0 or a B0 bar. So it's a quantum mixture of these two. So these spontaneously evolve.
The B0B0 bar spontaneously evolve into each other, or you can think of it as initially what's a B meson evolves into a superposition of a B0 and B0 bar. So that's why we have to tag when one decays, because we have to know, did it decay as a B0 or B0 bar, because it was in a superposition of two states. Once it decays, though, we know what the other one is. And so that's sort of the fundamental point we grab at in the experiment, is that we have to be able to tag one as what it is. So what we measure is the asymmetry in these decays. So what we look for, like for example, is that B bar going to a final state, and look at the difference in that decay rate to a B going to the same final state. So we look at the difference in the B0 or B0 bar rates over the sum, and we use that to get the asymmetry. So if the B0 had the same decay rate to a final state as B0 bar, that whole thing would be zero, and we'd have no asymmetry. So it's just sort of a normalized, the difference in the decay rates over the sum of them. And we get a time-dependent asymmetry. So what we can do is actually go and put this into the time-dependent decay rates. So the B meson, or the B0 meson, would have a decay rate that would look like this. An exponential, because of the finite lifetime, 1.5 picoseconds, plus or minus these oscillating terms, sines and cosines. So one of the advantages we had over the Kaon experiments done now 40-something years ago over this one is there were only a few decay channels available. You know, those Kaons decayed into pi-pi or pi-pi-pi. That was it. We have many, many, many decay channels available. These B mesons are much heavier. There's a lot more phase space to a lot of more different final states. So what we can do, in effect, is many experiments and check for consistency between them. So that's what we set out to do. And we wanted to test and validate the theory of Kobayashi-Maskawa, or better yet, shoot it down. So here's just an example of the kind of decay distributions we're looking at. So we look at the time decay distribution of the B meson. So we look at the difference in the position of the B0 and B0 bar decay. We measure it, actually, so the difference in the distribution. So this is an ideal thing, what you'd expect if you did a Monte Carlo in a perfect world. You'd expect to see a time-dependent asymmetry of the B0s decaying to a CP eigenstate, final state, would be the red ones, or a B0 bar. So what we're looking for is a difference in these two distributions. You can see if we actually integrated over all time, these distributions are the same. That's why we have to do it as a time-dependent asymmetry, because if it's time-independent and we just integrated everything in sight, we wouldn't see an asymmetry. So this time-dependent asymmetry appears as a shift in the time distribution, and hence the distance between where the two Bs decay. And this is a sign of indirect CP violation. Direct CP violation would show up as a different area under these curves. So if the area was different under these curves, that would be what we call direct CP violation. And indirect CP violation would be we just see a difference in these things. So where we do it is at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. You run actually 9 GeV electrons on 3 GeV positrons. There's 3 amps of current on 2 amps. So these are high-intensity machines. So this is not, by any chance, the highest energy collider. There are many higher energy colliders at Fermi Lab and in Germany, and especially Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. But this is the highest current collider, highest current accelerator. So we make B-bar pairs at about 12 hertz. So 12 times every second, B-bar pairs are made. And our detector is here to detect the products they decay into. The experiment is actually tiny by Large Hadron Collider standards. It's actually 10 countries together, 500 physicists. I hate to say this is tiny, this is huge to me, because I don't work on the Large Hadron Collider. 77 institutes, we have 31 Canadians. There's lots of Americans in the team, dominated by Americans because it's down in America. This is to give you an idea. For Large Hadron Collider people, this is just such a baby detector because it fits in a garage. It's less tall than, you know, 3 humans standing on each other's shoulders, basically reach the top story. So for someone who works at CERN, this is just a cute little baby detector. But it's got a lot, it's got the instrumentation we need to do it. So this is just a picture of the inside is a silica microvertex detector. So you remember I mentioned that what you have to do is we're watching these B0 and B0 mesons decay. What we'd like to do is precisely measure the difference in distance between one of them decaying and the second one decaying, because that'll give us back the time between the decays. And in order to get that, we rely heavily on this silicon microvertex detector. So this is a small detector inside. It's actually silicon wafers, and when the charged particle goes through, it makes hole and electron pairs, and we can reconstruct the particle's position to the spatial precision on the order of 15 microns. So you get very high precision position resolution on where the charged particles went
in this detector here. This is the piece we built in Canada, so I always show this, you know, made in Canada. So this is just a big drift chamber, big can of gas with about 35,000 gold-corded wires on it. Charged particle goes through, ionizes the gas, and we collect the ionization and use that to reconstruct where the particle went through. So this was strung on our campus at Triumph, is a particle physics lab on the south side of our University of British Columbia campus, so we usually show this. We didn't do this alone, actually. So some Italians came and they built a wonderful robot that helps string the things, and Princeton and several American groups also were came up to Vancouver, so Princeton put its logo on there, their lion. And we had our UBC one, the Triumph thing on here. So it was already an international effort, but we built it up in Vancouver because our local guys like to see some funding going to local things, just like you're going to have a lot of local building here for the Auger project, which is just sort of in your backyard, which will be fun. And electromagnetic calorimeter. This is a quartz bar, and actually photons in it will reflect down the finely polished, extremely parallel sides of the quartz bar. And what we use this is we look at the Cherenkov radiation coming off the charged particles as they interact in a huge tank of water. And actually the Cherenkov angle, the angle that the radiation comes off it, gives you some information on the particle species. Was it a proton, a kaon, or a pion? So we carry out the reflected Cherenkov light here. We put photo multipliers on the end here and use that to help identify the particle species. So that was just a unique sort of characteristic of this kind of detector that was invented by one of our collaborators at SLAC. So how we ran the experiment from 1999 to 2008 is when we stopped running. We recorded over 900 million BB bar pairs, 22 billion electron positron annihilations. So this is an interesting thing for our friends in computer science, because they look at this as a huge data mining thing. So we took over 4 petabytes of data, and we generated more, you know, almost that much simulated data. So it's a fantastic training ground for students who often work in particle physics, but then they go out and they're experts in large-scale computing, data mining, simulation and stuff. So we consider it to be great training for our senior undergrads and our grad students who work with us in research on this to deal with that amount of data. Now, we weren't alone in this. Actually, it ends up there were 2 of these so-called B factories. We called ourselves a B factory because we were making B mesons, remember, at 12 hertz. There was another one over in Japan at the Japanese National Lab, KEK. They had actually a smaller number of physicists. We used to joke at first, sometimes we were behind them, and we joked that we had too much interference. 520 physicists would interfere with themselves more than 400. In the end, we ended up both actually publishing the results for this, you know, finding CP violation in the B-Mason system in the same issue of the same journal here. But the detectors were very complementary. So if there were some physics beyond the standard model, there were some things that could have been discovered there and not with us. And thus, we both built our detectors, though, to really be able to investigate the charge parity violation. We both had some very different features that if there was new physics beyond the standard model, one or the other probably would have been able to, at that low energy, been able to likely say it. So in some senses, we were competing with each other, but there were many aspects of the detectors which were complementary to each other. Well, I should have put this, I moved this slide back. So here's how we measure the distance between the production vertex and the decay vertex. So I mentioned the electron positron annihilate. We make a B0 bar and a B0 meson. Let's say the B0 bar here is the one that decays into the CP eigenstate. So it'll go into a muon, anti-muon with a kaon. And so it would decay here. So with our precise silicon vertex detector, we'll get the positional position where it decays. The other one then would decay as a B0 and into a final state that we could label as a B0. And we'd measure the distance in the decay vertices. So a typical distance in decay vertices would be about 260 millimeters with a resolution of about 180 millimeters. So this is actually what we're measuring to find CP violation. So here's one example. And I mean, there aren't many examples of completely perfectly reconstructed events. People always say typical event. This is not typical. This is like a rare case where we've actually reconstructed every single particle in the decay. A B0 goes into a D meson with a pion. That D meson, excited D meson, goes to the lowest state D meson and a pion, and that D meson decays into K on a pion. So all the red particles came from the B0 decay. So this K, pi, pi, pi. And the blue particles here, the kaon went to a pi pi pair, and the B0 went to a
a Psi-2S with a K0, which went to a Pi-Pi, and this Psi-2S went to a pair of muons. And so those are the ones shown in blue. So you can see the mu, Pi-Pi. And so this is a completely reconstructed event where we can see B0 decaying one into a CP final eigenstate, one into another one which tagged it. So that's the kind of clean events. Compare this to what you see. I don't know if you guys have had LHC talks. So in an LHC talk, typically 10 interactions are on top of each other, and there's like 500 particle tracks. It's like, I'm a particle physicist. I can't even imagine how they reconstruct those things, because there's many events on top of each other and many particle tracks, but what they've got to do is pick out the highest momentum ones, and they use those actually pretty creatively to look for Higgs bosons. So what we do here now, so we've looked at these B0 decays, we've measured the decay distance between them, and what we try to measure is one of those parameters. Remember I explained the unitarity triangle had three angles? The easiest thing to measure is one of those three angles. I'll call it the beta, the second angle. If this thing is non-zero, which we were hoping it would be, then that would completely kill Kobayashi Maskawa's theory to explain the origin of charge parity violation. It's non-zero, so we were hoping it would be non-zero before we measured it. We do a maximum likelihood fit to the time difference distributions for those charge parity and oscillating samples. We fit 34 parameters, but remember we've got lots of data, so it's not like you can fit in element anything. Anyway, so we have lots of these. We fit our parameters. We fit for sine to beta. We use the B lifetime and the mass difference between the B mesons. And of course, if you're looking for an asymmetry in something, you can find an asymmetry in something that's not anti-symmetric if you just have some kind of biases in your analysis procedure or your hardware or anything. So we went through many, many, many control samples where we look at decays where there should be no asymmetry. And that would be not B0 and B0 bar mesons, but looking at initial states with charged B mesons. Those don't mix with itself, so we'd have no chance of having a charge asymmetry seen in a system where you started with an initially charged B meson. And so we've done lots of control samples. Actually, this was some of the earlier ones where the errors are much smaller now. Done lots of control samples to look for asymmetries where we know there shouldn't be asymmetry. And we've looked at hundreds of different channels with these for asymmetries. And we find no asymmetry in charged B decays, which gives us some confidence that we're not going to see an asymmetry no matter where we look. So when we expect no asymmetry, we see that indeed we see no asymmetry. And then we look in actually the neutral B mesons, and we see the asymmetry. So we can look at, remember, the B0 or the B0 bar decaying to the final state. And so this is what we see, B0, B0 bar. You can see there's an asymmetry between these two. And we measure this and fit for that angle. So we measured lots of these different decay modes. We measured them individually, and then we combined them together to measure that parameter. So unfortunately, what we found is that in this triangle, so we were hoping to measure that this angle was zero. If this angle is zero, then the triangle collapses on itself, and then that eta parameter in this Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix would be zero, and then we would have killed their model and said, oh my God, that can't be the origin of CP violation. Mathematically beautiful as it is, aesthetically not, some people think it's aesthetically beautiful, I guess. So that's what we were hoping to do. Now what we've done in the meantime, so after that initial findings, charge parity violation in the B-meson system, we've looked for all kinds of other things. We look at these so-called penguin decay modes, and I put a penguin under the penguin mode just so you can see why a penguin diagram is called a penguin diagram. It's actually a weak interaction where a particle comes, emits a W boson, and then it combines back. So these kind of diagrams are called penguin diagrams. Actually, there's a long story about it. It was invented at a bar over a dart game, but I'll tell you about that later if you want. Okay, so new physics would enter non-standard monocle particles, could enter via many processes, including such a penguin loop. Because you can see, actually, by this kind of loop, once you have an internal loop here, any particle, even if it's a particle way above the masses we have access to, could be mediating an interaction running around this loop as a virtual particle. So it can exist, the mass may be too high, but it has to do satisfy the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to do it quickly enough so it gets away with murder. You can always steal energy for a small time as long as you do it under h-bar, right? So in principle, we are hoping that we find some new physics here by looking at actually charge parity violation in diagrams that could only go, in decay channels that could only go, including one of these penguin diagrams. So we looked for many, many of these as well. And so that our strategy was to look at this KM matrix from many, many different viewpoints, many kinds of decay channels, including some that could incorporate particles beyond the standard model we know. So we were really hoping to kill that Kobayashi-Maskawa theory. Now, what happened in 2008, if you remember, is, oh my goodness, we didn't kill their model at all. We and our competitor Bell in Japan, we confirmed their model to such excruciating precision. Everything we measured, the hundreds of different decay channels, everything agreed beautifully with their model, and they got the Nobel Prize in 2008 for the discovery of spontaneous mechanism of spontaneously symmetry breaking in atomic physics. That was Nambu, and they, for the discovery of the origin of the broken symmetry, which predicts the existence of at least three families in nature and explains this mixing. So these guys actually were such sweethearts. So they got the Nobel Prize. They were writing thank you cards. They came over and celebrated with us everything. So it was sort of an honor to confirm their theory, even though initially we were kind of mean and we were hoping to kill their theory. So we tested it beautifully, and it was absolutely consistent and amazing. So this is part of their Nobel citation. So the Nobel citation actually even included, if you go to the Nobel Prize webpage, they predicted hypothetical new quarks, which have recently been appeared in physics, and as late as 2001, that's when we found charge parity violation of B-meson system. The two particle detectors, Babar and Bell, both detected these broken symmetries independently of each other, and these results were exactly, excruciatingly to such high precision what Kobayashi and Moskawa had predicted three decades earlier. So these guys were such sweethearts, they came over and celebrated, they had parties, they brought sake and wine and everything, and oh man, they were such sweethearts. Anyhow, so that CKM theory as being the origin of CP violation, it's been pretty well tested now. It was tested in the kaon system, but only from one point of view. Now we've actually hammered it from many different points of view. This is a beautiful, consistent model that incorporates charge parity violation. Oh, and here's their Nobel Prize ceremony. And they just sent thank you notes after thank you. They're the sweetest guys on earth. I don't know if any Nobel Prize winners are that thankful and sweet anyways. So what we've done is now combined our results with all kinds of other things. This looks like a complex diagram, but what it is there's many, 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 many different ways to test the KM Kobayashi-Moskawa model of charge parity violating, not only in systems of B-mesons as we did by measuring this unitarity triangle, but at Fermi Lab and Brookhaven and a number of experiments looking at systems with kaons, with charmless B decays, looking at even some of the neutrino interactions. So here's some of the CP violation experiments at Fermi Lab. I think Nick was involved in some of these experiments at Fermi Lab finding these things. So there are many, many different ways to actually attack and look at measuring these darn parameters. And every single one of these measurements has a locus of, you know, the range in these parameter space, eta and rho, which work. And you see there's one region of this parameter space that overlaps for every single experimental measurement. This one here, actually it predicted two bands, one there or one there. So there's just one area in this phase space that completely satisfies every experiment going, and that's sort of here, and that's exactly where we measured our parameter two. So, you know, on one thing you can say, wow, this is amazing. There's one solution and amazing agreement for this beautiful Kobayashi-Moskawa, a model that explains charge parity violation. Or you can say, oh, darn it, everything is consistent. We haven't found any evidence of anything beyond the standard model. It would have been nice to. Now, in summary, you know, the standard model of particle physics, man, it's amazing and self-consistent. We have verified the Kobayashi-Moskawa model of matter and antimatter as symmetry as leading to charge parity violation. We've searched for many signs of new physics, haven't seen new physics. We found new spectroscopy in old physics, but we haven't found any new physics. Such factories and like a Large Hadron Collider continue to be the prime place to look for new physics. But, you know, we started out trying to look at this charge parity violation. Remember, we see there's a teeny tiny charge parity violation in the B-meson system. There's a teeny tiny charge parity violation in the kaon system. But, you know, there's this huge baryon asymmetry of the universe. There's a huge matter and antimatter asymmetry on a universal scale, actually, which looks like, what we've measured in our thing. The symmetry we see in the B-meson system and the kaon system are too small to explain the large charge parity violation, which must have given rise to this large matter and antimatter asymmetry in the universe. So it's interesting to confirm everything about the standard model. It'll be interesting to find where it breaks down. So what we're looking at now is people are suspecting, boy, we've eliminated the quark sector as the source for this baryon asymmetry, matter and antimatter asymmetry in the universe. Actually, so there's a series of experiments that have just started now to look and say, boy, you know, that charge parity violation is not in the quark sector. And something must have given rise to the matter-antimatter symmetry of the universe. That mixing in the quark sector, there is charge parity violation there, but it's not big enough to explain the charge parity violation on a universal scale. Now people are looking down here and saying, boy, in this lepton sector, there's going to be mixing among these neutrinos. We know there's mixing in the neutrinos. And is there enough mixing here, and is there charge parity violation in a neutrino sector, which then could give rise to that? So unfortunately, what we could say is we eliminated the possibility that this charge parity violation in the quark sector would be sufficient to explain this huge matter-antimatter symmetry, the large CP violation on a universal scale. Oh, I just exited this thing. I'll get to the very end here. So possibly it's in the neutrino sector, not in the quark sector. So what are we doing right now? You know what? We're still running our experiments, and actually right now, I hate to say this as an experimentalist, while it's super fun running the experiment, and to the students out there, man, it's the funnest time you ever have is when you're running experiments and getting new results and stuff. But it was so relaxing to finish running the experiment because right now we're actually factories of running analysis and actually getting the last bits of physics out of our data. So we're still looking at inconsistencies in the standard model from these higher order diagrams. We're working a lot on studying these so-called penguin decays of B-mesons because those are places where physics beyond the standard model would show up. We don't have high enough energy to do Higgs searches the way they're doing a Large Hadron Collider. So we're looking for some anomalies in the standard model at low enough energy scales that we could do it. And so we've been searching for this and testing standard model, and that's sort of the state of this thing. And so, yeah, so we stopped running this experiment, but we're still getting our final results out.
We have time for questions and discussions. I might ask the first question. We talk about CP violation in the kaon system and in the B-quark system, and we imply that it could be related to the asymmetry of matter going into antimatter and antimatter going into matter and is responsible for it. And even though we know that the baryons, like the kaon or the proton, can't exist in the time
the hadrons
can, but we also know that the kaon and the bion system can't exist at the time that the annihilation took place, we speculate that because the neutrinos existed from the very beginning of the Big Bang, that their CP violation could be a better hint at this.
Yeah.
However, even that might be limited because what really counts is the bare quark CP violation. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be really hard to ever get at on this planet. Maybe with some cosmic rays that are up there attended.
But there's young people in the audience and they'll be...
Yeah,
but they'll be doing it.
but my point is that bare quarks.
Yeah.
I mean, in your opinion, is the neutrino CP violation going to be the answer, or do we really have to shoot for the bare quarks CP violation?
Well, that's speculation. Because if you'd asked me 18 years ago, I would have been betting money we'll find it actually right here in a B system. So otherwise we wouldn't have done these long experiments. We were really hoping we would kill that theory, right? So I don't know. I'm not a good speculator. Although I'm speculating the Canucks will win their game tonight because they're out of the series if they don't. But normally I don't speculate on physics except for actually I always speculate that string theory won't be the answer. But it's hard. It's a good question. So certainly there's a lot of people now that are putting all their energy and stakes into the neutrino CP violation bucket. And that's an order of magnitude harder for this to do than this. At least when you produce a quark, you have a good chance of seeing it. When you produce a neutrino, the most likely thing, by factors of millions, is you're not going to see most of them. You're going to see a tiny, tiny fraction of them. So that's a very hard experiment to do. And now, actually, the bare quarks would be even harder experiment to do. But, someone will come up with some ingenious way to access it, and I don't know what it is, so I'm not the one coming up with it, but some of the young people are going to come up with some ingenious ways to access these.
Other comments, questions, discussions, anything's open, really.
intriguing subject?
No. There's been, this is probably a really juvenile question, but it's been bothering me since the beginning of the talk. Why is there the assumption that there was, at the initial point in the Big Bang, a balance between matter and antimatter?
Oh, actually, we have astrophysicists here, but most astrophysicists will tell you in their models of the Big Bang.
No, those are cosmologists.
Cosmologists, okay. Well, cosmologists are kind of astrophysicists to me. But almost most of them will tell you in all the models, that had to be an initial thing, because we know a fermion and antifermion can annihilate into a photon and so on. That's a standard, you know, electromagnetic interaction. So that, you know, most of them will tell you it would have been very hard to have an asymmetry at that time. So they figure it must have been symmetric, and then that asymmetry involved by reactions which favor, you know, matter over antimatter or some of these things. So yeah, I'm not a cosmologist.
But I'd always thought it was a particle physics point of view.
Oh.
Because if you imagine, well, you probably never seen a Feynman diagram, but if you imagine a particle and an antiparticle annihilating, in order to conserve momentum, you have to have two photons come out. Alright? Well, now you back that up, rewind the tape, you have the two photons collide, and now you have two particles come out. Well, you have a matter particle and an antimatter particle. Why do we see where, as she asked earlier, where are the antimatter particles? We don't see them. So how do you account for that?
Unless there was some spin.
Photons have spin?
No.
Okay.
The universe could.
Photons have spin one, yeah. Photons do have spin one. But, you know, that's why you can only have two fermions annihilate, must go to two photons, not one, not three, because you have to conserve spin and parity.
Yeah.
It's also the one minus parity. But, so, you know, from a... That would be assuming that it was electromagnetic interaction, if there's some other interactions beyond the standard model. But another important thing is, you know, these cosmologists who WMAP, what they can measure on, based on the structure of these early universe, is they can measure the ratio of photons to baryons. So, you know, photons to things like protons and neutrons. I don't even understand how they get it, because when I see these maps of blob, you know, colors and whatever, I mean, it's a deep level analysis. But when they look at those ratios there, I mean, that goes back also to how they proposed the early universe was formed. You know, in the sort of relics we see, how many, what's the photon to baryon ratio, and then when we look back at that surface of last scattering, what was the baryon to photon ratio back then? So there's sort of all these things that sort of point that, you know, at the initial Big Bang, there must have been it must have been symmetric, and something, some physical processes caused the asymmetry, not the initial one. But I'm not a...
It's a good assumption, but it is the assumption.
It is an initial condition.
Yeah. I guess what you have to do is come up with a plausible model that would have that initial asymmetry that wouldn't conflict with any other measurements we have. So as far as I know, there is no such thing. But there is a very plausible model that they have, you know, pure energy going to equal parts, fermions, antifermions. That is a model we have, and it agrees with everything we know. But someone can come up with something, if, you know, that would be a cool thing to come up with. If someone can come up with some initial, how there was initial asymmetry, and then you wouldn't have to explain how it got to be that way if it was initially that way. But you'd have to have a self-consistent theory that agrees with every measurement and experiment we can do on Earth.
My understanding for your talk, you said, I think the CP violation source of K mesons system is well explained by standard model.
Yeah. And this Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix within the standard model. So they were right. When they invented that in 73, they explained it, and man, that explanation stood the test of time. Even after many new quarks were discovered, it was beautiful. I don't know how they did it so
well. Yeah, but still we have a kind of new source of CP violation. It's not explained by Kobayashi-Maskawa.
Yeah.
Through that, or K mesons, right? So my question to you, which the K mods leads to a significant new source of CP violation? Because you mentioned a lot of them. Experimentally, which one do you think we can focus on it?
So all the ones we measured have very small CP violation, and the very small CP violation in every decay mode we've measured agrees. Yeah, I exited again. All the every measurement we've made is consistent with the same values for A, rho, and eta. So every measurement we do has always led the tens, the dozens and dozens of experiments we've done always leads to the same value of eta and the same value of rho. So we're measuring this CP violation in the B meson system, and it's consistent no matter which way we get it. We get the same things. It's different than the CP violation in the kaon system, because the CP violation in the kaon system comes from the kaon mixing. So these parameters here that we're measuring when we measure this rho and eta, no matter which decay modes we measure, we're measuring the same rhos and eta.
Yeah, but the standard contribution to CP violation in this system is not enough to explain.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have kind of new sources to CP violation from new physics beyond the standard model.
Yeah, so there could be physics beyond the standard model, and we've been looking at that. We haven't found any yet. And it could be CP violation in the mixing of the neutrinos. So instead of the mixing of the quarks, that causes that we can see there's CP violation there, but it's small. It's not enough to explain a lot of the things we observe. But potentially, since we know so little about charge parity violation, we haven't seen charge parity violation in the neutrino sector. One thing we have seen at experiments, so the deep underground experiments at the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory at Kamioka in Japan, and there's some new proposals at Dussel in South Carolina, NOVA up at Fermilab, they've seen mixing in the neutrino sector, and if there's mixing is a necessary but not sufficient condition for CP violation. So the fact there's mixing in the neutrino sectors tells you, oh my God, there could be CP violation. So that's the next obvious place to look. So hopefully in the next 5 years, we'll hear results from those neutrino experiments. You know, how much charge parity violation is there in mixing in neutrinos? Will that explain this huge CP violation we see in users? Or if they don't see it there, if they can say, oh my God, we measured it, it's tiny, then you say, oh my God, now we've got to think of another possible source of CP violation. Yeah, it could be actually, so there, this is in weak interaction. There's strong CP violation, and that is absolutely minuscule, but there are some people in quantum chromodynamics have some, you know, beyond the standard model theories to explain why there would be more charge parity violation in the strong interactions, which nobody expects to see, but if you can make up some cool models where it would be large, and then have an experiment which could test it, then we'll go and test it, yeah.
Any other questions? We'll wrap it up. Let's thank the speaker again.